Hello, everybody, and welcome to Outrageous, our weekly podcast where good friends get together and talk about race, culture, media, politics, or anything else that pops into their mind. Yet again, I am joined by my two very best friends, renowned educator Jason in Washington, D.C.
Renowned. Thank you.
Renowned. And
I appreciate that.
And award-winning gadfly, Trisha, in Los Angeles.
Award-winning? What did I win? Tell me.
Chris gave you an award.
Not an Oscar. And I'm Chris. I'm a social worker here in New York City, and we get together to chat about stuff. So how's everybody doing today, tonight?
It's been a long day.
God.
I'll tell you that right now.
That's the way to start. Ooh, it's been a long day.
It's been a long day. I'm just letting you know.
Oh, man.
I'm excited, Chris. I want to congratulate you that you figured out how to turn on your microphone.
Thank you.
I just like for everyone to know that about 2 hours ago, Chris called me and said, well, tried to say he wanted to test out his microphone.
All right.
No sound was coming. And, you know, I was like, it was one of these things where, like, he's silent, he can hear me, I'm nodding and stuff. And so, you know, I was like, you know, I'm saying to him, you should maybe hang up and try to figure it out. So eventually he, like, nods and does that. He calls back 10 minutes later and explains that he had neglected to move the switch that's right by his hand,
of course.
In the microphone, from off to on.
Okay, great.
Which I just thought was great.
You know what I liked?
Thank you.
You know what I liked about that story? It had everything. You know what I mean? It had excitement, right? Because that was very exciting, wasn't it? You jerk. Mm-hmm. Shut up!
I just love how I feel like you have, like, deconstructed and reconstructed, like, whole CPUs, and you couldn't find the on button.
On button.
You know what?
That's how this stuff works.
It's been a long day. You know what? It's been a long day. So there it is.
Very original.
There it is. What's new for anybody? Has anyone done anything exciting lately?
No.
Oh, my God. What's wrong with us?
We're living our damn lives. That's it. That's all we're doing right now.
Oh no! This is where we are, isn't it?
Listen, it's a weekday. What else are we gonna be doing? We all have jobs, honey. We're not flouncing around. This is it. This is what you do. You come home, get on the phone, and start talking to your friends over a recording.
Recording a podcast. It's what the average American's doing.
Exactly.
It's what all the kids are doing. You know, sometimes I wonder, it seems like there's like a million podcasts out there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you think people just like, you ever listen to like random podcasts? Do you think random people are just going to find this and listen to it? I don't know. Because to be honest, like, I don't listen to that many podcasts. I listen to like 6 podcasts and that's it.
I mean, I listen to a few. I'm also on another one, as you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, I listen to as best as I can. I think podcast goes in phases. You know, sometimes you're really, really into it. It's just like a show. Sometimes you're really, really into it, and you can't wait to listen to what the other people have to say next week. And other times, you hit a bumpy part, and you're like, I don't care.
Hmm.
Well, I've had people lately say to me, oh, my God, you have to hear this podcast. It's so good, like whatever podcast. And then I'll listen to it. And I'm like,
it's definitely a taste thing. Not everyone's gonna respond to the podcast you like.
But so much more so than TV. Like I feel
definitely.
Yeah, that's right.
There's like, because I'm like really big into board gaming, right? And like there are a million board gaming podcasts out there, and where people review board games, and it's sort of like they haven't even like mastered the art of like speaking. Like, and I'm like, who the hell's listening to this? And then on top of that, they're 3 hours long. I was like, all right, who can listen to this? Who can listen to your review of a board game that is 3 hours long, longer than it would take to play the game? I don't know.
Well, for whatever it's worth, on our first publicly shared episode, the last episode, I did share it with several people, and I did hear some positive feedback. Now, whether that's just because they're being nice or they're people who are used to listening to my bullshit anyway, so they're already hooked, I don't know, but
maybe
we need to say some outrageous things apparently to get good at self-promotion, which there are plenty of models for that. There are plenty of models for that in our society today, so we should figure that out.
Say something crazy.
Send back all the Estonians. figure we defend as few people.
No, you got to pick an ethnic group that nobody knows.
With that, and then move up from there.
Let's get all the people from the Pluto. Estonians.
There's like 100 of them in the entire world. Yeah, get them out of here, shitty planet. Get out of here.
There are scientists who've tried to do that. They just keep getting into conflicts. It's a planet. It's a dwarf planet. It's an asteroid. I mean, no one can. It's a moon.
You know, like the teleporters on Star Trek?
Yeah.
They're trying to figure out how to make them. And there's like this discussion, because what would actually happen is that they would shoot your information through space, you'd be recreated at some other place and then destroyed in the first place.
Good luck with that.
But since we don't actually know what consciousness is, they're like, well, would you be you, or is this just like a fancy suicide / photocopying machine? Anyway, they've been struggling with this for years. I just think it's always fascinating, because in science fiction people are just zipping around like it's no big deal.
Yeah, well, I'd like to know who's going to volunteer to do that.
I know.
I think we will get it, but the first 10 people who volunteer will die. That's true. But then you can't test the consciousness.
Well, sure, but, you know, we can get, like, you know, not a cat, but we can get people who we wouldn't care, like, you know, Jared Fogel, the subway guy, like, you know, stuff like that. Line him up. Piece of shit. Anyway.
Why do you have so much animosity towards him?
Was that outrageous enough? Do you think Jared Fogel will listen to this? Like, where have you been? What?
What? Is this something I don't know about?
Yes. You don't know about Jared Fogel, the subway guy? He was like arrested for child pornography.
Yes, and yes. I misheard who you were talking about. Yes, I'm very, very aware. That's a good idea.
Let's move on to some topics of the day. I think Jason should go first.
I went first last time.
Trisha, go first.
All right.
Trisha's going first. Oh, my God. I knew you were going to say that, Jason. The moment I said it, I was like, oh, shit. He's going to say, I went first last time.
Well, I suspect I have, like, the most, I don't know, appealing topic, I will say.
Wow. If you do say yourself.
This has got to be... Like, what? Ladies and gentlemen, introducing Trisha and the most appealing topic of the hour.
It's
go
all
ahead.
Downhill after that. Just listen to the first part and shut it off.
You tuned in at the right moment. You can fast forward after this. Go ahead.
But, so my topic, Vanity Fair did a spread on Michael B. Jordan, the actor who was recently in Rocky, but better known probably for Fruitvale Station, and the director of Rocky, Ryan Coogler.
It's Creed, by the way. Let's Creed. Give it the...
Yeah, sorry. Let's give it the real shit. Name.
You just whitewashed
Creed. I said Rocky Creed. And just I totally understood it. I know,
totally
right? Well, I'm sorry. It became my Rocky, so I was like, whatever. But yeah, so yeah,
it's
sorry.
Black Rocky.
I know Black Rock. The movie. They
like
both
a comic work, book.
They both work together. They both work together on both films. They work together on Fruitvale Station and Creed. Really, there's a really beautiful black and white photograph. And Chris, I don't know how we're gonna do this, but it's a podcast, so it's hard to see. But I guess I can probably put the
or describe it. Describe it to people who haven't seen it,
so you can see. Basically, Michael B. Jordan is standing on the left if you're looking at the picture, and he has he's about a head taller than Ryan Coogler, and so Ryan Coogler is he's sort of holding his head as if he's pushing his head to his. Pushing Ryan Coogler's head to his shoulder. That's, I think, a description of it, right? Like, almost as if you're going to lean, like if two people were standing side by side and you're going to lean your head into the other person's shoulder, but you're not quite doing it. But Michael B. Jordan is holding Ryan Coogler's head as if he's going to sort of lean him onto his shoulder. For, I'd say, normal people.
Well, can I just say something, Trisha, if you don't mind? They're also... They're also staring into the camera. Like, I just want to add that detail.
They're both staring into the camera. Yeah. Ryan Coogler is sort of staring because he's actually almost to the side, so he's staring a little bit for the left side of his eye. He's looking out, and Michael B. Jordan staring directly into the camera. It's a closed shot, but there's a kind of intimacy to the shot. They're fairly close to each other. There's no angsty in the shot. It just looks like a tender moment. I don't think you would even probably attend to it in any kind of way if it was maybe two women. But it's startling because they're two African-American men, and they're it jumps out. And so people were having a lot of reactions to it online. And I follow a really wonderful guy that I've probably talked to about in other spaces, called Son of Baldwin on Twitter and on Tumblr. And he wrote a piece about it, about folks' reaction to it, negative reaction to it, on The Griot. And it's like, critics of Vanity Fair's Jordan and Coogler photograph reveal black masculinity is still enslaved. And so his primary contention is that the image is disturbing to people because black masculinity has really, really, really small, finite spaces in which to negotiate. And he sort of laments the tragedy of that. So I just wanted to get people, I want to get both of your reactions to the picture. What did you see when you first saw it? And what did you think of some of the claims that the author Robert Jones makes in his piece?
I think you kind of glossed over the internet's reaction to this picture, because I think that's central to what you're talking about.
Because, like, well, what's your reaction? I want to know what your reaction is when you first saw it, and then then we can get into what the internet, well, how the internet reacted.
The picture itself is pretty negligible. They're handsome men. I didn't think anything of it. The picture only came to my attention when I was seeing what people were saying about it on the internet, and I guess the insinuation being that they looked gay or something like that. And if you see the picture, you'd really have to be reading that into it. You would think that they were both in leather harnesses, lubed for the gods, the way that people were reacting to this. And there are two handsome men in suits touching each other, standing side by side. It really is no different than how I might stand next to, my brother or Jason or any one of my male friends. Now, I'm gay, so maybe that would be the point of, these internet trolls. But it was cute. It was intimate, yes, but not in, a sexy time intimate way. I didn't know, to answer your question, I didn't have a reaction. I didn't have a reaction to the photo. If there was never any fervor over this photo, it would have been beneath my notice. I've been like, oh, there's another picture of rich people who work in Hollywood. Okay.
Well, first of all, I'm all of a sudden, we have a certain amount of diversity among the three of us. I'm all of a sudden wishing we had a straight black man on the podcast to get. But as a white man who has been around plenty of straight black guys, I agree with what Chris said. I agree with you said, Chris. What we see here, the way that Jordan's hand is on Coogler's head, it's a very common way that boys and men will touch each other, whether it's saying hello or, if on the basketball court. We can talk about, we could debate the value of heteronorms, but there's nothing in violation of heteronorms that I see in this picture. The other thing is, you both use the words intimate, and Trisha, you said tender. I think even that's too strong. The fact that their gazes are out at the camera, at the viewer, I don't mean to critique it at all. I agree with you, Chris. I wouldn't think much of this picture, but really looking at it, I actually think it's a pretty normative masculine posture that they're in. I mean, but I agree with what you said, Chris, about people are reading things into it, because I look at it and I mean, the words that come in my mind when I see it are like, you know, Jordan is kind of saying, this is my boy, and we're good friends, and don't try to, you know, tear us apart. Like, a message that you sometimes hear in pop culture, I don't see anything sexual, homosexual, like, I just don't see anything like that. I'm shocked at the response that this picture's gotten. It doesn't look, it looks very normative to me.
Well, I think this is the problem altogether. The fact that, like you said, it looks normative, there's really nothing out of the way in it. But also, I mean, I think that's the point Trish is trying to get at. If this had been, like, say, Ryan Reynolds and Ryan Gosling in this same picture making these same poses, no one would have noticed or cared. And I think that's the point. Black masculinity exists in this very narrow band of the atmosphere, a very rarefied band of the atmosphere. And any step outside of that is too gay, it's too much, it's in some way it's not good. And I find this fascinating as a black man, as a black gay man, right? I find it fascinating because I think this hurts the community overall when we have this very narrow band where black men are allowed to the way they're supposed to behave, the way they're supposed to look. It's just not helpful to the community. And when we think about Black Lives Matter, and you know, the question always has become in the black community, like, which Black Lives Matter? And like, which communities are we separating out? So if we say, like, black gay lives or like black gay people don't matter as much, that weakens like the entire thing. I'm rambling now, but do you know what I'm saying? Like black masculinity, it's so brittle. It's so brittle that simply these two grown men touching each other, they're gay. It's terrible. It's off the charts.
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of a range of reactions, right? There's the initial sort of homophobic reaction. Like, people are like, oh, that looks gay. It seems gay. There's a lot of people using those kinds of tones. And then there are also people who are taking it from the other side, that it's also potentially disturbing to people to see two black men sort of in quiet with each other. And so that, on some level, is also threatening. I don't think people were reacting to that aspect of it as much. I think people were really sort of, I think the tinge of it was really sort of the homophobic element in the photograph. Now, weirdly enough, my interaction with the picture was, I saw the picture, I saw Son of Baldwin tweet out the picture, and I looked at the picture, and I was like, oh, that's really, really sweet. That's a great picture. Hot. Awesome. Great. Nice picture. It's black and white. You don't see a lot of black and white pictures. So I was like, that's really hot, you know? And I moved on about my business. 2 or 3 days later, I see that he then writes a piece, and I was like, wait a minute. Are people reacting to this picture? But again, of course, it's really difficult for me because I sort of inhabit a space where I know quite a lot of gay people, and I'm really comfortable with that world. And I know mostly gay men, so I'm also very comfortable with that world. So there isn't a part of me that's looking at that and going, wow, that's so gay. There's a part of me that's looking at it going, wow, that's really an attractive picture. But beyond that, I'm not sort of aware of what fears this is bringing up. So I was just kind of astonished by the reaction. But then I started to think of a lot about some of the things that have been coming out this year. Jason, I don't know if you've known, but you know, I've been seeing some things about, like, there's some football players that people think are gay but aren't out, and the reaction that, and they're African American, and the reaction that has gotten, because one of the football players is likes to dance with his friends, you know, on Instagram feeds, and somehow or another the dancing with his friend and the joy that he has in doing that, it's like a signifier of something. And so I really kind of wanted to explore this idea of, is this unique to black men, do you think? Or yes. Do you really think that this is, because remember, we also saw that escalator video. It's a very popular escalator video of this guy just randomly touching other guys' hands, and it crossed racial lines, age lines.
Wait, what are you talking about?
Do you remember? Yeah, there's a video of, I think it's a spoof, really. There's a video of this man who essentially rides up and down escalators and accidentally brushes his hands against other men's hands. And the reaction that he gets from other guys, it runs the gamut from people threatening to beat him up just for the brushing of the hand and then maintaining eye contact throughout, to some people laughing it off, to...
I know the video you're talking about, and I think you're mischaracterizing it a little bit.
He brushes his hands, right? He brushes their hands, and then he stares at them.
The exercise was, like... So the exercise was the actor, let's say, is going up the up escalator and reaches out and tenderly brushes the hand of a man coming down the down escalator just at random. And then makes eye contact in sort of like a come hither sort of way, like they're coming on, like you'd come on to someone. And then, yes, there were, you said that people laughed it off. I think one dude laughed it off, but the rest of them were getting violent and shaking their fists, and the idea that this man would come on to them, and the idea that masculinity is so fragile, that even though you're not gay, like instead of someone coming on to you, instead of being flattered, you go to straight up violence. Like, what? And to answer your question earlier, Trisha, you said, is this just a thing with black men? I would say yes. Like, there's
you
something,
do?
Yeah, there's something in particular with black men, because think, what's that show that LL Cool J does now? Lip Sync Battle?
Oh, yeah.
So, two of the highlights this last year on Lip Sync Battle was Joseph Gordon-Levitt took to the stage and he lip synced to Rhythm Nation by Janet Jackson in full 1989 version Janet, like the hat, the
Virgin!
Not virgin, I meant version. Like her whole Rhythm Nation 1814, the black slacks, the hat, in drag, right? So, and he killed it. And then not recently, I think at the end of the season, oh, what's his name? Everyone thinks he's really hot, but his face is weird.
Channing Tatum.
Well, I don't know what's more disturbing, that description or the fact that Trisha knew exactly who we were talking about.
I already knew it had nothing to do with Chris's description of his face, because I just knew the lip sync battle, but it's like...
That was a great, like, taboo moment, like playing taboo. Like, you two just killed it. You two just killed taboo.
No, shut up. Stop killing my point. Shut up. So,
no, we're not old friends for nothing, apparently.
Anyway, Channing Tatum in full drag does Who Run
with
the World.
With a lace front.
With a lace front wig on. Cuts out, and he lip syncs to Beyonce's Run the World. And then Beyonce comes out, and all the queens were like, ah! The point being that if Michael B. Jordan had done that... He'd be done. So to answer your question, yeah, there's something that we do about black men, about their masculinity. It's really, really fragile. Yeah. I have read a piece that my friend wrote about black boys who had been molested by priests. I mean, who else? Mm-hmm. It's like priests and the subway guy. anyway... And part of it, you know, part of what he was talking about was just that there's like an additional shame for black boys who grow up and identify as heterosexual, right? Because they're constantly, and this part is not unique to black men, but for black men, it's sort of like even more strong, like the idea that no one must ever find out because then there's no going back from that. And I don't know what's the root of that. I don't know who that serves, really.
Well, so I'm glad you asked what the root of that is, because this is where I actually disagree. You know, we read this article by Robert Jones with the picture, and you know, in the article, in this opinion piece, you know, he includes some of the tweets and whatnot, which I thought was great, and then he reacts to it, but I like a lot about the piece, but there are a couple of key things I really disagree with him on. So my answer to the question that you just asked, like, where does this come from? I mean, I do think that, you know, for hundreds of years on this continent, there has been a concerted effort. Well, there's been an effort to instill fear among everyone of black men and black male bodies. And because of that fear, there's been an effort to control black male bodies. And this has taken on different forms in different generations. But it's been a constant, and you could say it's what we see now with many of the issues going on, you know, between law enforcement and black men. So, I think black masculinity and black men is probably a better way to say it, have been, you know, under attack would be an understatement. Yeah. From the time that they were first taken off the African continent and brought here. So I think that plays a big role. Where I disagree with this piece is that the statement is made that, you know, the reason for this kind of, I don't know what you want to call it, hyper-masculinity or this valuing of heteromasculinity is because black men see white power and want it. I'm not sure that I agree with that. I personally think it's much more this hundreds of years of subjugation of black men that would explain it more. Because I think that, you know, if I think about what you just said, Chris, which I agree with to some extent, that, you know, while there's plenty of homophobia and heterosexism among white men, the way in which white men may feel the need to express their masculinity or protect their masculinity is different, and it's not it's maybe down a couple notches. And so I just think it's not an emulation necessarily. It's a response to this subjugation of black men, in my opinion. And so I just that
so you
did
think
not
the hyper,
ring true to me.
So the hyper masculinity is a reaction to the attempted subjugation, not an actual attempt to reinforce what they see in black men. That's what you're saying?
I'm not sure I understand your question. I lost
well,
the track
because,
of, like, they...
No, I was just trying to figure out. I mean, I'm okay with the point that you're raising, Jason, because I was wondering at that as well. I was wondering at this idea of white masculinity being presented as a kind of ideal that the black man was attempting to perpetuate or to reflect. I don't know. I don't know if I want to.
Oh, I disagree with that. I don't think that's the case.
I agree. Right. I don't.
I think white masculinity and black masculinity are really two different things. And I don't know if black masculinity is a reaction to that. You know, just case in point, like Channing Tatum can dress up like Beyonce and do that whole thing, and no one will doubt his heterosexuality for a second.
Well, but because he has a very specific thing, though.
No, but it's not particular to Channing Tatum.
It is particular to Channing Tatum. Because, yes, it is. Because you know what? Because people doubt... That happens to white men all the time. Channing Tatum rides a very, very fine line. He does. But the reason why he can, first and foremost, is that his wife is always present, because she was present there. And he does mock his masculinity as well. He actually goes overboard because
he does. That's true.
Yeah, he is perceived as hyper masculine because he used to be a stripper. So there's like no room for him to ever be conceived of as any other but a heterosexual. I'm trying to figure out now what if who fear very much that they will ever be conceived of as homosexual possibly, especially white men, white actors, they may not have been willing to put themselves in the same place. And I agree with it because in some ways he's considered a beta male. He's already considered someone who is in touch with his feminine side already. Those are the kind of parts, that's his sort of brand. I think if somebody else who had a very hyper-masculine brand were to do that, I think they might also have struggle as well. I'm not disagreeing with the idea that there is definitely a difference between black masculinity and white masculinity. I'm totally not disagreeing with that. But I do think that there is a central theme around masculinity, period.
I agree with that. But I think I also agree with Chris where that the band seems to be narrower.
Very much so.
More cases for black men. There are exceptions all over the place, right? Like, I mean, there's Tyler Perry, and his masculinity is something that's been a topic of discussion, and yet he's widely accepted, very successful. You know, Martin Lawrence used to dress in drag, and I mean, so I think there are exceptions all over the place, but I think we all agree that, broadly speaking, the band of what is deemed as acceptable for black masculinity is narrower than white.
Now, is that because I would wonder, do you think that's the same thing that would play out in, say, like Latino communities, Christopher? So does that mean then this is really about subjugation issues?
You know what? I don't know. You would think I'd think about this more. I know, I don't want to get too off topic, but like, I know in the gay community, I know that through my interaction with white gay men, they have a particular idea about my masculinity and my sexuality, and those rules are different for them. And I just and also Latinos in the gay community get it as well. Like there's something hyper, especially about Latino men. There's something hypersexual about them, or it's expected to be about them. So I think I really need to think about it. I'm not certain where I think it comes from, but I'm gonna blame white people for it. Actually,
well, I mean,
of course.
I mean, well, let's just go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we could. I mean, and that's the thing. You know, I wanted to sort of go. I do sort of agree on some level with Robert's argument, but at the same time, I also don't want to retreat from this idea that that masculinity is not always about the subjugation here. Like I want to know if there's any sort of wiggle room in other cultures or other spaces where white supremacy is not dominant, and is there more fluidity there? I don't know, you know.
Well, I think it's really hard, I think, to make generalizations here because you have countries around the world that are not necessarily been subjugated by white cultures that where homophobia is rampant and much worse than it is here, and yet they would define masculinity and heteronormative masculinity very different. So I'll give you an example. I mean, I've spent some time, you know, in countries in the Middle East, in Jordan and Egypt. You know, men there will hold hands walking down the street out of friendship.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They almost always greet each other with kisses, things that you do not see here. And yet my sense is homosexuality is like, fuck.
No.
You know what
it's
I mean?
Taboo. Like,
so,
yes.
To say, I mean, that's probably an understatement to say it's taboo. So, I don't know. This just gets into, it's just a really nuanced topic.
It really is. Because in a weird way, I often see, and I've said this to other people when I was traveling, I say, you know what? I see men interact and touch each other in with a high degree of intimacy that I don't see in America. I really don't. And so I was even thinking to myself that I wonder if I even gave that portrait to men in other countries, would they have even had any of those kinds of reactions to it? Even if that country is completely homophobic too. Do you see what I mean? Like I think there's
yeah,
like
that's
there's
exactly all, you know? What you mean.
Because I mean if you walk around in an Italian city, dear Lord, I mean
the men are all over each other all the
time.
Yeah,
I mean, just a tremendous amount of affection, a tremendous amount of, like, intimate touch. And so that would have been reflected in the picture, and they would have responded to that. So it's curious to me, though, that it doesn't necessarily mean that they would be absolved of, you know, of homophobic ideas either.
Given what you said about the Middle East, I want to rethink some of my thoughts because I think, Jason, it's not homophobia necessarily that we're seeing here, but it's really interesting. I'm gonna give this more thought. I mean, quite often, I think these things are just warmed over misogyny. It's the idea that these men could in any way be anything less than men that makes people want to go into a tizzy.
It's a good point. I think there's an element of that. I think it's a very good point.
Yeah, I mean, my long-standing theory has been that a lot of homophobia is warmed over misogyny. If we thought about women differently, we'd think about homosexuality differently.
Yeah, I mean, I think so, because I think on some level, I will say this. I do think there's an element of people reacting to almost like the gesture in the photo of a kind of like a push. I mean, because it all depends on the context, right? It's like Jason said in the beginning, you could easily see this on a basketball court, and the context is just right. Because
you'd
the
see more on
so
a basketball
masculine.
Court.
Well,
more.
Yeah. But isn't that the funny thing?
As
isn't
someone
that the funny thing? That...
Who's someone who may or may not have spent time watching the men play basketball at the West 4th Street basketball. Someone
bodies.
Who may or may not spend time at West 4th Street doing that, let me just tell you,
You'd see a lot more than just that on the basketball court.
Well, yeah, I mean, see, the thing about it is it's all context. Because that picture, transfer that picture after it looks like they've just got hit like a basketball game or
right.
something. Why not?
Right.
It was a totally right. different
hit
feeling.
A basketball game.
You know, sorry.
You know, like, what you're saying.
No, I just meant that in the sense that they just finished like finish having like a round and then they were stopped. You know, that's what I meant. But like in this moment, the moment is so clean that it is necessarily reads as intimate. You know what I mean? Like, why are they
I totally
so well
agree.
Dressed?
Yeah. You know what I mean? Right. If their shirts were off and one of them was holding a basketball, I'd be like, oh, they just fucked somebody up. Yeah. They just won a fucking game.
So you could put all these other things on it. Anyway, I just, you know, I thought it was an interesting just topic to explore because I wasn't sure if it was fully white supremacist ideas or if it was sort of misogyny as well. So I think it was interesting that you brought that in, Chris. But I also think it's also heavily culturally laden as well in terms of American culture. So it was just an interesting topic.
Can I say one other thing before
sure, please.
We move on from this? So I mean, there's one other element here I almost hesitate to bring it up because it brings in all kinds
you
of bringing other
up
shit.
Religion?
No, I wasn't going to bring up religion. We could certainly talk about that. But,
no, we can't.
I think there was, in this whole issue of black masculinity and homophobia and heterosexism, you know, you had that period, I don't know when it was in the 90s, there was that book that came out on the down low.
Yes,
and
I was just thinking
you've had this,
about that.
You've had this narrative that's been prevalent on some black radio stations and in some African-American communities where there's been a lot of blame relegated towards black men who are in heterosexual relationships but are, as the book title says, on the down low. And so, this is very nuanced, but I think, I've had the experience of hearing black women talking about how important it was that when they date a black man that he has never been and will never be attracted to men because of not only the cheating element of that, but the health risk of that. I'm not representing anyone's point of view here. I'm just saying things that I've heard. But I think that did not help. Let me say that. That whole conversation about there are black men in heterosexual relationships who are secretly sleeping with other men, contracting diseases and bring it back to the women they're in relationships with, like that has not helped this whole conversation around black masculinity and heterosexism and homophobia.
And also this idea too, though, that homosexuality is really a threat to the black family, because if the black family is under threat, then this is like another example of it. So, I mean, a similar argument can be made for something like abortion, right, which is a woman's right, but suddenly that becomes different for black women because suddenly your job is to protect the race, and so you can't, you know. So those things also get layered onto it, but I did think about the down low issue, because what I thought about was the idea that we had to even come up with a distinction called men having sex with men, because there was this notion that you couldn't have a kind of homosexual community discussion around black men. And so I think that's also what was also enraging about that image, is this idea that homosexual interactions between black men could actually be tender, could actually be relationship-based as well. Do you see what I mean? Like, it's fine if you're just hitting that, because sexual desire. But if there's actual real affection and companionship and all the things that, quote-unquote, go in a relationship, that's even more threatening.
Yeah, that's all well right. said. That is well said.
Let's move on from this, but I would love to come back. I have like a million ideas about this. I'd love to come back to ask.
Why you want to come back it to you and you should have been thinking of it?
Now I'm getting yelled at?
Wait, I have one more thing. I'm sorry, there is one more thing. I remembered. There's one more thing I did not like about this piece. Sorry, I have to say this. So
what?
I'm just going to read you this quote. The great silence of our time is that black queer love is the only thing, emphasis mine, standing between black people and oblivion.
What?
I thought that was a bit of an overstatement. I just want to share that.
Like, yeah, I mean, I think anytime...
That did not resonate with me.
Yeah, anytime I see anything that says only, because, I mean, what do you, where's the room for heterosexual love? I mean, I don't think I want any sort of primacy right. given to any kind of love. I want to say love, pure love right. that's and, happening between and amongst, regardless of race, gender, and regardless of sexuality. I want that to be acknowledged, but I don't know. Yeah.
I don't even know what to say to that. I mean, okay. Well, sure. Everyone's
well, entitled. Hello, you're the queer man here. You ain't got no ideas?
I don't know what to say to that. Like, someone's making a statement like, black, queer. It's, we're all careening off the edge of the abyss. The only thing that can stop us, gay black love. I don't know what to say to that. Like,
if doesn't make if everyone sense doesn't well, become gay, well, we're all doomed. I mean, like, everyone
well, must well, be gay. I don't know.
But I think I would expand it. Like, I sort of said this earlier. I think as a community of black people, we have to understand queer love, and we have to bring all black people in. Like, we can't say, like I was saying before, we can't say black lives matter. Oh, unless you're transgender, then a group of dudes can beat you up in an alley. Oh, black lives matter unless, oh, what, you're gay? I'm going to dump boiling water on you and your boyfriend while you sleep. Those sorts of things. Like, so in that sense, love is important in our community, but queer love itself saving us all, like, I don't know what that means.
Well, I think queer love in the sense that I think the larger point is that if we can't get to a place where we can be receptive to queer love as a community, we might very well be in danger.
Exactly.
Because that is the most threatening
love.
Right,
we all agree about that.
I think that's the thing. I think the question is it the thing that's going to save us? Maybe not, but it might. But if we don't reconcile ourselves to that, that doesn't bode well for our community overall.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think that that's the thing. So that would also reflect a real transformation and a real embrace of ideas that are outside of sort of the white heteronormative space, even.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll see.
All right. Cool. Well, let us move on from that, and I'm gonna go next with my topic. It's sort of like a topic light. We are three intelligent people who have been talking for a length of time.
Speak for yourself.
So clearly, someone has to bring up Donald Trump. So here we go. Sorry.
That's how I feel.
No, I'm ready. I'm excited. Let's do it.
It's pretty much the rules of America right now. If you're having a conversation, you have to say Donald Trump. So I don't have a topic per se, because honestly, I don't think we can say anything that hasn't already been said. It's just I've been curious/nervous about the future, as far as Donald Trump is riling up a part of the country. And I'm not certain that genie can be put back in the bottle. There was a supercut on the internet about all of his different calls for violence. You know, like, oh, I would punch that guy in the face, and I'm going to pay for legal fees. And then that's where it started. And now it's ended up with him saying things like, you know what we did to protesters back in the day? That guy would be carried out here in a stretcher, which to me, immediately, the first thing I thought about was just sort of, you know, black people having dogs set on them and hoses, and the tragedy at Kent State in the 70s, 60s. Like, what is he referencing, and why is he referencing it? And then recently he said, you know, the Republicans, by the way, are like freaking out, and there's a lot of talk about having a brokered convention, which would mean that they would pick the Republican nominee at the Republican convention in June. So Trump said, you know, what will happen if that happens? I represent many millions of people. There would be riots. And I was thinking, okay, it's only March, and he's already talking about riots. Like, is he organizing some sort of coup? So I guess my question is, I just want to have a general Trump off. Like, I'm just curious what you think about the level of discourse. You know, we've sunk to the very low when we were talking about his dick size. But now this feels particularly dangerous to me, because he's a reality TV star. He's not a politician. He only knows how to up-level and ratchet it up. I'm not certain he's very aware of the fact that genie that he's letting out of the bottle. But I'm worried about the future of this. Like, where do you go from this?
Well, I'm not worried so much about bombs going off. I think my problem with this is that I think that this is just going to be the pattern of Donald Trump, which is that he's going to incite people to violence, and then they're going to be left holding the bag. Which is kind of like what happened with any of his properties that he convinces an investor to get in on. And then when it's like...
that is true.
Yeah, you know well what I mean? Done. When it's not...
Well played, Trisha. Well played.
Yeah, right? When it's not working anymore, he simply just... he'll just abandon ship. And so I feel like what he's done is... These people don't recognize that Donald Trump has zero affection for them. He has real contempt for them. He says it openly to them, but they love that because it's like going to the abusive boyfriend. Well, you know, he's telling me the truth, and there's a part of me that just wants to know the truth. The reality is, I'm less worried about Trump and just more worried about whether that party has the ability to get these folks in line. Because they've set this groundwork. Trump didn't set this groundwork. He just kind of came in on the end of it. But it's the people, the sort of mainstream part of that party, that set this in motion all along. So are they going to be willing to pull the switch? Are they going to be willing to take their lumps at the convention and say, fuck, we're brokering this convention, and we'll do with it what we can, and we're going to call in the National Guards if people go crazy? I mean, are they willing to go there? I just don't know.
Well, I continue to be optimistic, and I'm going to focus on the positive, although I find all of this extremely disturbing. But I do think that the Republican establishment, seeing some of the rhetoric that they have promoted or at least accepted or tolerated in the past several cycles, reach this level of manifestation and then react negatively toward, I think that's good for our country. I mean, I'm, again, very disturbed by Trump's rhetoric, the number of people who are attracted to it, and then the rhetoric of some of the people who are going to his rallies, not to mention the violence. I mean, it's awful. But I think that the fact that both of our parties are abhorred by Trump and are seem at this point, I mean, Trisha, your question, I don't know the answer to it. Your question's a good one, and I don't know what they're going to be willing to do. And, I mean, you know, I'm not always terribly sympathetic to their leaders of the Republican establishment, but I actually, they're in a tough bind. Like, it's hard to know what the right thing is to do, because if they go to this convention, and he's clearly gotten, you know, more of the popular vote than anyone else in the party, which looks very, very likely, and then they don't let him be the nominee, like, that could lead to violence. I mean, as you said, Chris, Trump himself said that will lead to riots.
Yeah, he's prepping them for it.
So they're in a tough spot. In the long term, though, I'm going to be optimistic and say this is going to be instructive. This is being instructive to the Republican leadership that if they want to have a future as a party, and if their rhetoric's going to lead to the scaring up of a old white male base, which they know is a losing equation in the long term to be successful as a party, they're going to have to change that rhetoric. That to me is a net positive.
What about a signal to the American people? Forget the Republicans.
Like, yeah, how is that a signal
to us that there's something deeply wrong with our political system? When a blowhard reality star can almost run away with the presidency. Now, I don't think Donald Trump will really be president, but I cannot believe he's gotten this far. And he is allowed to comment. He's allowed to comment on matters of national security, on other people running who hope to be the leaders of the free world. Like, the fact that he's allowed in the room, I think, should let us all know as Americans, like, there's something deeply wrong with our process. Like, maybe this is all just a game by Bernie Sanders to get money out of politics, because that's the only reason he's here.
I totally disagree. Actually, I very strongly disagree with you.
What?
He is here because his message is, as you said at the beginning, Chris, this is not the example of money in politics. You know, Scott Walker, who got demolished by Trump, is an example of money in politics. Like, some of the other candidates are. Trump, I actually don't think this is that problem. To me, I don't think that this... I mean, there are plenty of problems with our political process. This is a manifestation of problems with our economy. It's a manifestation of problems with our policies about drugs. I mean, I think this is much more about, to me, so my answer to your question, Chris, what is the message we should be taking from it and how should we respond? It is advocating for better economic policy that allows for, you know, broader, wider distribution of wealth and, you know, people in the working class and low-income households of all races having opportunities to get jobs with livable wages and take care of their families. I think it's much that, to me, that's my takeaway, is that we need to be pushing for economic reform, for responding to heroin addiction, you know, opiate addiction, with, you know, from a healthcare perspective and not a law enforcement perspective. To me, that's the message. It's not the process, because the process is working the way it is because he is inspiring people, and he's inspiring people because there are people who feel desperate.
Well, I mean, and that's the thing. I think the thing about it is that I feel like at this point in time, like, even though I want to leave it on the Republicans' lap, like, that's my question is, can we galvanize that group in any other way, right? Because the thing about it is that if Bernie Sanders was more effective, he could have spoken to that group. They're the same group. It's disaffected white folks, right? So part of the problem, I feel, is that, I mean, this is just really the failure of the whole current primaries, but on both sides, to be honest. That's really what's happening, right? Because it's like you've got, like, Hillary doing her dance, and then you've got Bernie somewhat ineffectually doing his dance, and Trump has just been able to kind of come in and enter a space that is not really a space for him. And it just drives me freaking batty, because there are legitimate things that you could do to actually draw those people in, like Jason's saying. Well, because if you just dismiss them as racist, that's not, like, yes, listen, a lot of them would love to draw up a bridge and, you know, put up a barricade and all of that
a
stuff.
A wall, not a bridge.
Bridges. Like, you know what I mean? Or a barricade.
Made for by Mexico.
By Mexico. But a good chunk of the reason why these folks are here is because they have been ignored. Their wants and their needs have been ignored. And Trump hasn't even created a path for them. Have you noticed that?
Their wants and their needs are untenable. Like, they want everyone except for people who look like them out. Like,
that's not their primary want. That's not their.
Chris, that's every society with a disenfranchised population. You could transplant that in any country, and you get the same thing with people living under these economic conditions.
So you have to activate.
Then what is he activating? Because he doesn't have any policy.
No. He's not activating policy. This is what I'm saying. Listen, he's activating their sentiment, but they will respond to policy initiatives if that was offered to them in a way that was going to actually be real. The problem is that none of their party members have done that, and they failed to do that for the last 8 years. So they're left here. Do Republicans really want to bring that population out of poverty? I mean, you know what I mean?
It's capitalism. They don't want to bring anyone out of poverty. It doesn't work.
Well, that's the problem. And I think that, you know, under 2008, we had this an economic downturn. And what you heard from Republican leaders was, you know, take regulation off business and that will create jobs. Everyone will be fine. And, you know, Democrats had a very different approach. Neither approach, even though, you know, the economy is growing, neither approach has helped raise wages. And you have people who have lost wealth and lost income since then and have not recovered. And so neither party has delivered for them. And that's why Trump, I agree with Tricia, you know, people are angry and they don't know where to go policy-wise because neither party has offered policy solutions that have done a damn thing for them. And Trump's rhetoric is activating that sentiment, and he's not making the same kind of promises that have been broken or not delivered upon, you know, for so long.
He's going to break the promises that he's making, but they're not promises that seem that are directed at any of the things that were traditionally touched on before. I mean, think about it. It's the same thing with Bernie. Bernie's like, let's just tear the whole thing down. Okay, good, Bernie. Thanks. That's going to be great. And then Hillary looks like she belongs with every single moneyed person ever. And then you've got Trump, who is moneyed and is just like, hey, I'm not even going to talk to you about any of those policy stuff because you don't believe in it anyway. I'm just going to build a wall. And they're like, yes, build a wall, because you know what? Guess what? Maybe that'll contain our jobs. Maybe, I mean, this is what happens when you have reared a generation of people with no ideas about how you're going to try to solve their problems as Republicans. They haven't been doing that. They're real problems. I mean, this is the thing. It's like part of it is that we have to kind of move away from the fact that we have gotten trapped in seeing these folks as just racist. Because guess what? White people have always been racist. But, you know, that's just a given. Let's just call that as their base. But aside from the fact that they're... Well, listen, listen, come on, let's just not even, and it's not a bad thing or good thing, I'm just, it's, let's just act from the beginning.
I think the white people you're calling racist might disagree.
I mean, the country's racist, it's always been racist, those elements have always been there, but let's make that a baseline. Let's assume, we say this is a white supremacist culture, so racism is embedded there. So then the next step is, given that these people are racist, but they still want to feed their kids, they still want jobs, you know what I mean, how do you offer them a way out? The Republicans have not done that, consistently failed to do that. So Donald Trump just seems like a, you know, he's just a wonderful thing to come along to promise something that feels like it's going to do some good. But the, you know, what it should have done was woken up the Republicans to be like, you know what, we have not delivered any policy ideas, no initiatives that's going to save this group. How are we going to save this group? They haven't done any of that. It's been empty.
Agreed. I think it's just a wake up for you guys are both like, oh, so wake up for the Republican Party. I don't disagree, but I think that like,
but it's also wake up to the Democrats too.
All Americans need to look at this and be like, oh shit, fully half of the country is totally fine following this Piper off a cliff. That's weird.
It's not one half. Let's be careful.
It's not one half. Right, I know half.
Listen.
But you know what? Think about it, though, Chris. It's not so much off a cliff. Think about the other people who are attracted by Bernie. They also want to follow that guy out of this thing. Right? So maybe these people want to follow Trump off a cliff, but then there's also a group that wants to reject this, too. So essentially what you're seeing is groups of people rejecting business as usual now.
So we're saying nobody likes the country the way it is, except for the people supporting Hillary, who are like, oh, business as usual will be just fine. We want political corruption out the wazoo.
No, it's not that. I think that people are just – I think you've got a measured group supporting Hillary who's just like, you know what? This is as good as it's going to get maybe. Damn. And let's just make change in incremental ways. Because, I mean, listen, if you've read all the reading – listen, Hillary doesn't think anything is fundamentally wrong with the system. Have you seen any part of her that suggests that?
She wants to be Obama light. She wants to be Obama too. Just sort of
I mean, she doesn't fundamentally...
She wants to be president, is what she wants to be.
Yeah, she wants to be president. she wants to stay the course. But what you're seeing is, actually, in a weird way, what you're seeing from both Trump folks and Bernie folks is a rejection of the current way of doing business.
Well, then, I feel like that's only going to amplify the next election cycle, and it will keep amplifying. This is why I'm worried. Like, the rhetoric on both sides, I just don't know where it ends up.
You should be worried, because usually what happens with people with a group of white people is that they burn things down.
Well, remember, if...
I mean, I don't mean to say, you know, that's just more
the
likely.
Election, the last
homegrown terrorist, remember?
The last time I could think about... last time an election was like this fucked up was like in the late 60s when Nixon was elected.
Mm-hmm.
So much, I don't want to go on record and sound like an idiot, but so much shit happened in that election cycle that Nixon ended up being president. Like, that's just, let that sink in. But that was like back the McCarthy era. RFK was assassinated.
Vietnam.
Yes.
Vietnam. So, we were in Vietnam.
What's his name? Segregation Now, Segregation Forever.
George Wallace.
Yes.
George
Wallace. He won five states. He won five states in a primary. I bet you we could name the five states.
Is it the same states that are always...
Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia,
one of the Carolinas, maybe?
South Carolina. And before this is over, I'm going to check this, and I bet you I'm right. But anyway, that was really
Louisiana.
Yes. That was really fucked up election cycle that ended up giving Nixon the presidency, which now that we've had the benefit of history to see that that was probably the wrong thing to do.
It was really ratchet from day one.
And so I feel like this like feels similar. Like there's going to be, I just wonder if
we're just going to fumble the ball, and it's going to end up, you know, wherever it's going to end up. It looks like Hillary at this point. I just hope that we're making that decision because it's best for the country and not just in reaction to the two nut jobs holding
it. It is in reaction. Hillary's presidency is in reaction to the time. And, I mean, that's really sad to say. And if it does end up coming to fruition, it is strongly in reaction to. Because what's sad about it is that because you've got this wackadoo Trump on that side, you can't even engage in the issues Bernie's really raising. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. You can't even have that dialogue because you're so frightened by the thing that's happening to the far right. Mm-hmm. And in a different space, you might have been able to have this conversation about Bernie, but it's like, I mean, I'm using myself as a judge, which is that I sit around and I'm like, oh man, I would have had time to actually process and sort of deal with Bernie, given a different space. But honestly, I feel like we just can't now. I'm like, I want him to close up shop, get your folks in line, let's all make sure that we get all the Democrats out, let's have no confusion, you know what I mean? Yeah. Democrats and independents. You know, because I don't know if you've been seeing the latest figures, but Republicans are voting more than ever.
Well, okay.
They're voting more than ever for Trump. And that raises the question, if he doesn't get the nomination, will people come out for the Republican nominee? Which I think seems unlikely, actually. I mean, it's very hard for me to see the Republicans winning this election, no matter what happens on their side. They're so fractured. Their base, you can't even use the word base. People who are voting in Republican primaries are so divided. I don't know who, Trump or anyone else.
It's not so much about the vote, to be honest. I'm just worried that it's going to get violent, to be honest. That's where I'm really
Well, I'm worried about that, too. No, I'm worried about that, too.
That's definitely. Ugh. All right, on that note, let's...
Thanks, depressing note.
We got into our 15 minutes, 20 minutes of talking about Donald Trump, so that's good. He'll be very pleased. So... Jason, take us home with your topic, and it better be good.
I doubt it. I'm just letting you know.
Trisha starts with, I have the most appealing topic, and then we get to mine. She's like, I doubt this one's going to be good. I told you I had the most appealing topic.
She's been consistent the whole time. She didn't like the Trump topic. She's already poo-pooing yours.
I know. I'm poo-pooing all of it now.
I would like to start by saying I'm reminded that when we were debating what name to give this podcast, Chris, you suggested, one of your suggestions was Liberal Orgy, and which I'm always hesitant with the liberal label, but I'm going to round this Liberal Orgy out with the environment. So, this is news that broke a couple months ago, but I'm still kind of reeling from it. The fact that in 2015, car sales hit a record high, and which cars were, leading that record high? What were the most popular cars? It was pickup trucks and SUVs. Oh, and here's what I don't understand about this, and I want you two to explain to me. First of all, pickup trucks are made to haul things. Most people I see drive pickup trucks never haul a damn thing. Second of all, sport utility vehicles. They're driving around and they're paying for gas for this whole part of the vehicle they never ever use. Second of all, SUVs, from the moment they were introduced years ago, like when we were kids, sport utility vehicle, I'm like, if you go off-roading, that makes sense. 99% of these people don't go off-roading. Why do you have a sport utility vehicle? And so even just from a common sense point of view, why people are spending the money for these big vehicles and to put gas in them. And, of course, that leads to the last point, which is these cars, they're obviously more expensive than, sedans, and they're more expensive to fuel. And, I know that in this country we have this insane disagreement about whether the fact that we have all these cars spitting out, toxins from the cars, whether that's having an impact on the climate, I think it's pretty clear it is. But even if you don't agree with that, everyone has to agree that, like, the stuff that's spit out is not good for us to breathe. And so, like, if we want to have, like, clean air and, you know, the earth be a place that our children and grandchildren can inhabit. I just don't understand why. I mean, I know everyone says because gas prices were low, so people felt like they could afford it. Which, first of all, it's so short-sighted. But even that, it's like, oh, gas prices are low? Then I'd be happy to buy a car that will make it impossible for my children to live healthy lives on Earth. I don't understand it, so you two, please explain it to
me. Jason, you know, I was with you until you got all We Are the World with my children aren't going to be. Your children are going to be fine, first of all right? It's their children that are going to have to deal with brown air.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, so let's get it right.
You know, Beijing already has it. China already friggin' has it. L.A.'s got it much of the time. Like, this is not a futuristic, you know, post-apocalyptic scenario.
Listen, the car industry was at one point booming in America, and the moving of cars is like was at one point central to the economy. I don't know necessarily how central it is anymore, but the thing is there's a lot of money to be made in it. So the people buying SUVs, people buying these big vehicles, there's something distinctly American about it, and because it's advertised in such a way. People aren't
moving to Canada.
Decisions. People aren't making these decisions based on fuel efficiency, right?
Yeah, that people was just a lie.
Based on like, oh shit, look how big my car is. Chicks are gonna think my dick is this big. I don't know what straight men are thinking. I assume it's something along those
lines. Is that
lines.
What it is? Is that it's sexual capital?
That's
I don't
it.
Know.
That's I don't it. Know. I don't know what it is, but you know what? When you were talking, it reminded me of just. There's this idea that people, there are a sect of people who actively don't care, anti-environmentalists, yeah. who believe that we aren't actually having an effect on the environment, and they want to mock those who do. There yep. is something called rolling coal. Do you know what this is?
What is that?
I haven't heard of rolling coal. No.
Oh, set your face to stun, because you're going to be pissed. So this is, what rolling coal is that people who like, have trucks or these big monster cars, they change some part of their engine, they remove filters in their engine that you're supposed to have in there, and they pay like something like $1,000 or more to have these changes made to their car. And what it does is it allows the car to emit extremely sooty exhaust from your car. And what they do is like people will pull up alongside like a Prius and like spew this sooty exhaust all over their car.
Oh, God. I drive a Prius. I'm glad that hasn't
happened. Get ready. Get ready, Jason. But this is a real thing. And, you know, people are altering their vehicles because they just are like, oh, well, no, we're not affecting the environment. And if you think we are, then you're stupid. There's something, there's a big, I guess it's ignorance. But this brand of consumerism and car ownership, and the bigger your car is, it's. I think it's distinctly American, and I don't think people are making those decisions based on the environment. Trisha,
yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I just think that people like what they like. They don't really. Well, listen, let me alter that. Social pressure is a compelling thing. And so until you are able to shift people's perceptions of people, of folks who drive SUVs and do things that are anti the environment, I don't think you're going to get much traction. Because I don't think people actually make those decisions because they want to be thought of favorably by themselves. You know, I think you have to kind of have government incentives, real strong government incentives for changing your behavior. So there's got to be some sort of reward, cash reward for driving a better car. Maybe you're getting like a tax break at the end of the year if you have a certain type of car. I just think those are the reasons why people do what they do. Those are the reasons why they change their behavior, right? Because like remember back in the day when you had those weird styrofoam things at the supermarkets and at fast food joints, and people didn't necessarily change their minds about it. It just became impossible for you to do it, right? It was like unseemly. Now people gave you looks. What? Why is McDonald's still using this? You know, it just became a culture where that was just not appropriate anymore. And so people are like, listen, I just need to fall in line because I don't want to be the one behind the eight ball here. So I feel like that's what has to happen. Like you have to kind of create a cultural mood where this is just not okay anymore. Where women are going to be giving you strange looks when you drive around in that big old car that goes nowhere. It's still too...
yeah, well, good luck with you that. Know? It's cultural.
Yeah, I just love that. It's cultural. And it's cultural, but that means that it can be changed. Because it is cultural, it can shift because we have seen cultural shifts. But you have to create the right incentive and the right space for that shift to happen. And you can't do it based on the idea of goodwill. Goodwill has not gotten anybody anywhere.
So, look,
environmental
what you're saying is probably right, but what frustrates me, though, is, look, I do believe that people are wired to pursue self-interest. Like, I think that is a fact.
Sure.
But what gets me here is that I don't see how it's in your... I mean, I should shut up, but I don't see how it's in anyone's self-interest to pay more money for a big fucking car that you're not even going to use for all the size it has. And yeah, gas prices are low now. They're not always going to be low. They were high just a couple years ago. I just, even in self-interest, like, I don't understand. I don't know. I don't get it. I don't know.
Well, that hasn't really met the road yet, because I have seen people who did park their cars because it became expensive to drive it. So what you would have to have affluence of events where that was not possible. Do you know what I mean? Where suddenly it was like, you know what? Lots of people, gas is too expensive or it's too costly, whatever. There'd have to be a series of things that happen that would create the environment where suddenly an SUV just no longer makes sense. It would just seem silly to do it. But for right now, it just hasn't come to that point yet. It just doesn't feel like that. So until that happens, people are going to keep doing it.
You're obviously right. I just don't understand why it hasn't come to that point yet. Like, to me, it's crystal
clear.
Well,
because it still has value to people. Like, people, because see, you're assuming people are making these decisions based on some sort of logic, but yeah, they're not making these logical choices about what is what's good for them in that way. Maybe it's good for them to get stares from people going, ooh, that's a nice big car. And yeah, I can imagine that I'm driving it on the rough road, but I'm not really driving it anywhere. You know?
We're talking about consumerism. I mean, people are constantly buying things that are not good for them or their environment. You know what I mean? Like, the face scrub that I used to use had those microbeads in it.
Yeah.
And when you wash your face with those microbeads thing, you're like, oh, my face, I'm exfoliating, I'm so pretty. It goes down the drain, and like, you should see like billions of these microbeads. They dread, it's destroying the environment, right? So, but people will continue to buy it. Actually, I think it's being outlawed in some states now. But, you know, it's just, or labels, or anything that we buy, we're not making rational decisions about our consumer purchases. You know, rational decisions on that level do not suit capitalism, really, right?
Right.
If we were making rational decisions, we'd all be driving Leafs.
Yeah.
Or Prius or something like that.
Yes, let's do it.
All right, Jason. Okay, Jason. But you know what I mean?
We don't make rational decisions.
We don't make those
decisions.
That's
not a part of how we do it.
We destroy the environment. Yeah. We destroy our bodies. I had McDonald's for lunch today. I fully knew what I was doing.
That's true. Everybody assumes, and this is kind of part of the big problem with sort of public health education, we all assume that left to our own devices, when we point people in the right direction, they will go there. They just don't. You know right. What I mean? It's like we have to recognize there's a self-destructive gene as well.
Also,
that's true. Even Freud said we have a drive to die.
Yeah. We do. So that we're always battling that, and I think that need is always we never take that into consideration as sort of public health folks. If we did, we'd probably develop better campaigns. But we always think, no, if you give people the right choices, they'll make the right. No.
Can I just say this is barely related to your topic?
What?
Michelle Obama and her whole like healthy eating for kids and the backlash against that.
Was hilarious.
When she,
oh
just,
my
like,
God.
She went into schools and she's like, God. Hey kids, how about having an apple instead of like six of those Jell-O shots or whatever they call it in school. And parents going to school, they interviewed proud parents saying like, I passed extra caramel apples in little Devin's lunch because take that, Michelle Obama. I feed my kids whatever I want to feed them.
that's right, honey. You have another 4 packs of potato chips. Like, what is that? What are you doing?
Was it Sarah Palin who was like, oh, they're trying to tell us what to feed our kids?
Oh, God. Or Michael Bloomberg tried to get theaters in New York to serve smaller size. Like, currently, the sizes that we have at movie theaters, it goes from, like, you know, beach sand bucket to, like, industrial waste container dumpster. You know what I mean? Like, that's the sizes. And Michael Bloomberg was like, hey, maybe less than 6 or 7 gallons of your favorite high fructose corn syrup. And people are like, what? How dare you? And there was this whole thing like, go to the movie theater, buy 2 of those things, and let Michael Bloomberg know. I said, what? Let him know how quickly you're willing to get diabetes? Like, what?
This is so ridiculous. Oh, my God.
But that's, and I want to say, I haven't lived anywhere else. I've been around the world in III. But I haven't lived anywhere else. But I'll tell you, there's something distinctly American about that.
It is. It's like now how like Americans are embracing their ignorance of certain things. Well, fuck it. I don't need to know.
Yeah.
What's the value in knowing it then? All right. I mean, okay. It's like a willful like cowboy mentality. I'm gonna go roam out there in the desert. I don't know what's gonna be out there for me. I might get killed, but I'll do it. Damn you.
Yeah. So Jason, the answer to your question is, listen, we're a nation in decline. You know what I mean? We're all going downhill. Sorry about it.
That's great. All right. Thank you, too. It was very helpful.
All right, no problem. Bring all your quandaries to us.
You know what? It's because Jason is like made of such goodness sometimes, and I'm always like, Jason, come on.
I know, Jason. I feel like we're always down on your topics because you come from this shiny, happy place, and we're like, you know, we're like the two cool kids by the smoking doors in high school. We're like, cut out that shit. I'm Mr. Homework Kid. You know what I mean?
Oh, man.
So let's slide into recommendations, which is some media experience that you saw, heard, read, that you think other people should see, hear, or read. Anybody? Anyone want to just jump in?
Well, I'll just mention, I'm not necessarily recommending this, but
thanks.
You know, we were talking that we talked about Trump today, and I was kind of amazed that Slate has this Trump cast. I listened to the first episode. Yeah. I have very mixed feelings about it for a whole host of reasons. I'm not sure I even recommend it, but it's just interesting. Like, they've decided there's clear bias. I mean, they clearly are like, Trump is a fucking idiot and this guy needs to be stopped.
The premise of the show is like, this is a problem. America, how did we get here? Like, right?
That's yeah, sort of and like how can it be stopped? Yeah. So it's like, definitely crosses the line of journalism. And then, I don't know. It's like one of those things, like, by giving it this much more, 2 things. One is, we're giving it more attention. Is that a good thing? 2 is, the people, I would guess, who listen to Slate, like me, are not the people that need to be better informed about Trump. Like, there's probably already consensus. It's not like the people going to Trump rallies are going to discover this on iTunes and be like, oh, I didn't realize, you know, he was an incompetent businessman. So anyway, there's my anti-recommendation.
Well, thanks for twisting the segment, because it's not anti-recommendations, but whatever. I'm going to make my recommendation. I saw the most recent episode of Broad City, which is a show on Comedy Central about these two millennials, Lana Jacobson and Lana Glazer and Abby Jacobson play like these two 20-something-esque women in New York City who get into hijinks. The show is so funny, and it's a great take on young people. I mean, people younger than me. Also, it's a great take on New York. I thoroughly enjoy it. The last episode had a cameo by Hillary Clinton herself, and it was just super hilarious. I recommend, if you're not watching Broad City, watch it.
I didn't know about that.
It's so much fun. Like, you'll die.
Oh, yeah. So this is actually in continuation from my topic last week. Somebody smarter and cooler and better than me at this moment.
Me?
I can always improve. No.
I knew Cruz was going to say that. I totally knew he was going to say
that. Sad day.
You just but set Tennessee, that up. You just lobbed him that ball, Trisha, and invited him in.
I gave it right to him. Listen, I've not been a friend with this guy for a short time. I know exactly where he lands. Right there.
Yep. Pretty much.
So last week, you know, I talked about the Nina Simone thing was my topic and the thing I was really thinking about. And then Ta-Nehisi Coates did a piece about it on in The Atlantic. And I just think it hits all the spots that it needs to. And then he also followed it up with a response because the distributor of the film gave a response that was tone deaf at best. So now there are two reaction pieces by Ta-Nehisi Coates on the Nina Simone biopic, and I think they're both worthy of reading. So that's at the Atlantic Monthly.
Ta-Nehisi Coates has got to be the busiest black man in America. Sorry, Obama, your title has been taken away by Ta-Nehisi Coates. He is
well just
everywhere.
Now.
Do you know he's writing Black Panther? The comic book?
Are you introducing this topic to me when I ask you outright if you read Black Panther and what do you think this is going to look like? And you're like, ah.
I don't know because I've never read Black Panther in my life. But I feel like I'm not certain. I don't know. I don't know what he's going
to
do with it.
You'll have to see. You'll have to see. He loves it.
We'll have to see. I think it's great. I mean, as a comic book aficionado myself, I don't like guest writers on titles, but we'll see what happens.
He seems to have a strong history of it, at least from what I can tell from the exchanges that he has with people online about it. So I was actually considering picking up a comic book for the first time ever because of it.
And if we know anything about him, he's got strong points of view, and he's very well thought out. I'm going to have a tangent recommendation.
Sure.
Speak about Ta-Nehisi Coates. I listened to This American Life, and good luck finding this, but months ago, there was a story written by a friend of Ta-Nehisi Coates, and the whole story was about how they were really good friends, and then Ta-Nehisi Coates became super powerful and famous, and just how they lost touch. And just really about the mechanism and the process of that. And he talks to Ta-Nehisi Coates about it. And it was really, I thought it was really kind of cool. It was just really cool to see like these two struggling guys and one of them makes it and what happens. It's not as dramatic as like a movie would have you believe. Like it was just them talking about the process of how that happened, I found really interesting.
That sounds gay. That sounds gay. That sounds like...
Yeah, and then at one point...
Just to bring it back. It's totally
at one point, Ta-Nehisi put his hand on his friend's head and kind of leans into him as they both looked off into the distance. And then everyone in the bar there, I was like, oh my God, are you guys gay? And they ran out screaming.
Well, that actually sounds really good. So find it and send it to me, please. I'm not going to do the
too
Google.
Lazy. Anyway, this has been a lot of fun, guys. So... Oh boy. Until next time, you two.
All right.
Have a good night.
Have a good night.
Bye.
Bye-bye.